Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode. This is Virginia, as usual, and with me for this episode is Spencer.
Hey, everyone. This episode, we're going to be continuing our Gathering Storm read-through, starting with Chapter 12. Before we get into it, we want to first off give you our spoiler warning. You know, we are obviously talking about things that have happened in The Gathering Storm, but also all the previous books. So if you haven't read through all of them and you don't want spoiled, you probably should come back to this podcast later.
Yes, definitely. And we also have a tendency to range far and wide in addition to talking about The Wheel of Time books, and have occasionally been known, occasionally, to bring in crossovers from other series, movies, books, TV shows, whatever crosses our mind in the path of conversation. We will try very hard not to spoil any other series or to have the editors insert a spoiler warning if we do, but we just want to warn you that anything is possible in this and every other episode that we do.
Yeah, very much so. And now, before we dive right in, we also want to make sure that we thank EncyclopediaWatt.org for the chapter summaries that we're going to be using. Our summaries of the chapters are not quite word for word, but they are derived from the summaries that are available on EncyclopediaWatt. So we want to thank them in advance.
That's right. Encyclopedia-Watt.org is a fantastic website. It's a treasure trove of information and, you know, links between one. If you can't remember the name of a character, you can find it here. If you can't remember who did what when, you can find it here. It's a great, great website and a huge resource for Wheel of Time fans. So again, thank you to them for doing all of that work in the first place and making it available to all of us fans of the Wheel of Time. So I guess not having any Wheel of Time news this particular episode, we will plunge right into our chapter read-through, starting with Chapter 12. And it is entitled Unexpected Encounters. This particular chapter is from Egwene's point of view. And over a month has passed since the last two chapters in which she appeared in The Gathering Storm 6 and 8. We find Egwene walking through the White Tower with her Red Aja escort. As for Elida's orders, there are almost always two of the Red Aja with her. Egwene is still upset that Rand has allowed Ashaman to bond sisters. She is thinking how much he has changed since the Two Rivers, and she thinks of Gawain, wondering where he is. Suwan will just have to deal with them. She is still extremely unnerved about the news about Halima. Today, Egwene has training with both Medani and Benai Nalsed. Egwene wonders why Benai has summoned her for a second session. Benai's study is full of skeletons, including that of a human being. There are stacks of books everywhere, including the sum on the reign of Arthur Hawkwing. Egwene practices some weaves, then, none too subtly, Benai asks for advice on how to deal with the sitters. She's in trouble for knowing about the 13th depository in the library, information that she derived from Egwene. Egwene mentally thanks Sylviana for her advice on simply refusing to accept unjust punishment, and gives Benai excellent advice on that subject. No one would know more about unjust punishment than Egwene Alvear, I think. And as soon as she leaves Benai, Egwene gets a note to attend Nagora, who works Egwene on logic problems that seem to relate to dealing with an aging and frustrated warder. Then she gets a summons to Suwana, which is her first meeting with a sitter. Suwana offers her a place in the Yellow Aja, even though Egwene is not strong in healing. Egwene is very surprised by this, but she urges her to begin meeting with sisters of the other Ajas to help mend the White Tower. Egwene then goes to her long-overdue session with Medani. Asked why she took so long, Medani replies that she did not want to draw Elida's suspicion. Egwene then asks why Medani does not flee the tower, but she will not answer her. She asks if she has turned to Elida before or after Bannon outed the Ferris, and she furiously replies that she hates Elida. She admits that they were pillow friends as novices. Egwene figures that Medani is trapped by an oath and, instead of telling, asks her to show what is going on. She teaches Medani the weave for traveling, and Medani takes her to a basement corridor where she warns Egwene of the danger and wishes her warder were not out of the city. Medani takes her still deeper then and knocks on a door. A warder, Adsalan, opens it, and Siana, Yukuri, Saren, and Belicene are there. Egwene asserts her authority enough that they divulge their purpose and plan to seek out the Black Aja. Saren states that she believes that Elida is the lawfully raised Amalun. Egwene states that Suwan was unlawfully deposed, then asks if they found any Black Aja among the sitters who raised Elida. Belicene admits that they did. That would have been Talim. Since only 12 sitters were present at the vote, that means that Elida was unlawfully raised as well. Egwene says that they are all serving the Shadow as long as they remain divided. She then orders them to make reuniting the Tower their prime mission and orders them to remove the fourth oath from the Ferris. The sitters do not disagree, and Egwene and Madani leave. Madani can barely believe that Egwene has pulled this off. Egwene replies that they are wise enough to understand what needs to be done, they're just afraid to do it. She wishes that there were more like them and Sylviana in the tower. They hurry to return before Egwene's Red Aja escort becomes suspicious. Wow, there's a lot in that chapter. That's pretty interesting stuff.
Yeah, it's amazing to see just Egwene being the Amralyn in a novice dress in the White Tower itself.
Well, you know, we talked a little bit the last read-through, and unfortunately, Spencer, you weren't able to be with us, but Andrew and I talked a little bit about how the boys have all grown into their roles of commanders in one aspect or another, not only commanders but noblemen, even though they all deny the fact in their head, especially Matt and Perrin. And yet, you know, these roles of authority, the mantles may have settled on them unwillingly, but they have grown to fit them, you know. And so Rand in particular now dominates a room when he comes into it. Even, I think, Min and possibly Elaine have mused on the fact that even if he weren't the Dragon Reborn, he would be one of those men who would walk into a room and have everybody's attention and everybody listening and obeying what he had to say, because that's just the sort of person that he is. And I see Egwene fully growing into that role. I mean, she's come such a long way from being the innkeeper's daughter. There is nothing of diffidence about her. She is in command and in charge.
Yeah, she definitely has grown into that role here. I mean, she's summoned to these different sisters, including a sitter, because they want her advice. They won't ever admit that they want her advice. I'm not sure exactly what they're telling themselves about why they're calling them to, or calling her to come talk to them. But that's exactly what's going on. They are asking her for advice about these different things. I mean,
Benay.
I don't know. But she's asking, okay, I've found out this information that I shouldn't know. What do I do about it? And then Nagora asked her about a simple thing just to deal with a warder who's aging, frustrated warder is the wording that's used here. And then she gets a summons from a sitter. So just the range of things that people talk to her to deal with, and she deals with them all perfectly and gracefully the way that an Amralyn should, a good leader should be able to deal with these things. Obviously, most sisters wouldn't be able to randomly call the Amralyn seat to their quarters the way that they can a novice, but they can still go to her quarters and talk with her.
Yeah. Well, it's really brilliant the way Egwene has handled this, and really the way she's handled this and her plans for dealing with the rift in the White Tower are worthy of a much more mature and skilled woman. I mean, she has made her, well, she already was, but she's made herself the exact opposite of Elida. Elida is capricious, domineering, and arrogant. Egwene is calm, rational, reasonable, sensible to the extreme, and very, very skilled at understanding what people need and giving that to them. I mean, she is like a mother to the novices. She's like a confidant to the other sisters. And she's like, you know, the head of, like a dorm mother to everybody else. And she doesn't put herself forward. She just is always there when she's needed and able to dispense sound and sensible advice and comfort. And yet she's so good at dealing with all of these problems. She just lays it out for people. And yet, and by that, she has just become what people needed so badly in the White Tower that they turned to her for all kinds of things. It's really quite shocking when you think about it. And the idea that Solana would offer her a place in the Yellow, that's amazing. I mean, she has never shown any sign of healing ability whatsoever, you know. And yet they want to collect her for their Aja. I mean, she reminds me here comes a crossover, which reminds me a little bit of Harry Potter. He was never, in the beginning particularly, a more diffident, quiet, unassuming, shy sort of person than Harry Potter. But because of who he was and then because of who he became, people were always wanting to basically get close to him and collect him. Either they were his absolute enemies or they wanted him around. And Egwene's really become that way. This chapter really points it out more than any other how much she's truly grown.
Yeah.
You're right. The difference between the two is that Elida,
I don't know what that comes from,
but Elida.
Elida, that's the electronic,
yeah.
Elida version.
it's like E. coli, only worse. No.
Oh, God, yeah, E. coli, that's her new name. That should have been her Devani name, E. coli.
No, but the big difference between the two of them is that Elida sees herself as a ruler. And so she acts like a tyrant, whereas Egwene is much more of a leader.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the big difference, is Egwene is willing to lead these people, not just rule over them.
Mm-hmm. She points out something that, well, actually Robert Jordan was wise enough to know, but he presented it through Elaine, that there is a difference between leading and governing. Both are important in being in charge of a nation or any large group of people. And Egwene has the leading part down pat. We really have yet to see if she has ruling down, governing down, but it looks like she will. I think she's going to become one of those very capable Amyrlans that is able to delegate authority where needed and able to take care of everything else herself. I mean, just the skills that this girl has evolved, you know, just in the last couple of years is quite astonishing when you consider that she really hasn't had any mentors. I mean, Rand did have Lon, at least in some respects, and he had Moraine to help him and so forth. And Elaine was, you know, she was born to the throne. She was born to rule, if nothing else, as high seat of a house, a major house in Andor. But she grew up as the daughter heir. She received lessons. You know, obviously, Perrin didn't, and neither did Manny. They had the examples of their fathers, who were strong, capable men as well. And Egwene, of course, had the example of her father, who was the mayor. And I suppose that might, you know, I just thought of that. I suppose that being the daughter of the mayor might have stood her in good stead, too. But she probably saw a lot about how Bran Alvear handled the council and, you know, the women's circle and so forth and so on. So I suppose in a way she did have a mentor, too. But nothing immediate apart from the few lessons that she got from Suwan. That's really, I guess Suwan would have had to be her mentor in that respect. But I don't know how much time she really had to teach her as much as she seemed to have learned. She obviously had an innate ability to deal with this long before anybody. I actually kind of forgot about Suwan, but yes, she definitely was her mentor.
Well, and then there is a reason why Suwan influenced the ruling, governing coven of the small tower to choose Egwene to be their, what they hoped would be a puppet Amyrlan. There's a reason that Suwan tricked them, really, into getting Egwene, and that's because Suwan saw that Egwene could be this strong Amyrlan.
I'm not even sure if Suwan realized in the beginning, because remember she said they made a very bad mistake, didn't they? What they thought was the plump grunter for the table turned out to be a live silver pike as long as your arm, but then I made that mistake first. I remember that quote because it sticks in my mind because it's, well, it's funny because it's one of Suwan's fisherman sayings, but it just sticks in my mind because it's really true. I mean, they all made a mistake. They all thought that they were getting a young girl that they could push and pull and manipulate, and they got nothing like that. They got an Amyrlan just waiting to spring forth, fully fledged, you know, like, what was it, Athena from the Brow of Zeus? I never get that right.
and you could be right, because honestly, I think that the Egwene that went from the White Tower to Tyr, I think she would not have been that good of an Amyrlan. But I think a little bit of what happened in the Stone of Tyr, the growing up she had to do there, and definitely the experience she had with the Aiel Wise Ones.
Oh, yeah.
Is what really got her to the point that when they called on her to be her puppet Amyrlan, she was able to take control of the situation and turn it around on them. I think she would have been a puppet if she had not have had the Wise Ones, who have just a completely different outlook on life than the Aes Sedai.
Well, you're right. You know, I take that back. Egwene actually has had all kinds of mentors just not directly, except for Suan. I totally overlooked the wise ones, too. Of course she learned how to lead and govern through them, because basically that's what they do. I totally missed that call. Yeah, so you're absolutely right.
And it is nice to see that Egwene is finally finding out about the Black Aja hunters.
Yeah.
Through that, she's able to say with a surety, it's not just, well, yeah, but because before that, they really had no argument about Elida's raising being illegal, being unlawful. But now where they know that at least one of the sitters that raised her was black, they know that Elida should not be the Armorland seat.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. It's amazing how all these things have fallen into place, and really, it again, to sort of digress a little bit, it again gives me even more admiration for the intricacy of the plot lines that Robert Jordan has woven to do this masterpiece. And you think of all these tiny little puzzle pieces, that some of which you've been building for books and books, and really over the course of 20 years, it's astonishing to me. It's just astonishing. The other thing that amazed me about this was that she taught Medani the weave for traveling. I really thought she was going to hold that close. And I was kind of surprised that she trusted Medani to that point. I mean, she was still worried just before that she, you know, was going to turn back to Elida just to escape some of the punishments that she was having to undergo. I'm also kind of surprised. I'm not surprised, but to me it seems so much something that's needed. But she's still upset about Rand allowing the Ashaman to bond sisters and vice versa. That always seems a little hypocritical to me. I mean, it's just okie-dokie fine for sisters to bond any guy they want, whether he's an Ashaman or not. But it's just not okay for them to do the same. I think that's really...
Well, that's probably the worst of the education that she received as an Aes Sedai, the belief that the Aes Sedai are better than any man who can channel, and in fact, lots of men in general. You know, the forced bonding of the Aes Sedai to the Ashaman is just, well, and we know that even though Elida did send the raiding party to forcibly bond the Ashaman, Egwene never agreed to do anything like that, and so it could just be the idea that of the forced bond that she objects to that strongly, but I think it is more the idea that the Aes Sedai are bound to Ashaman,
yes.
And the
yes.
Ashaman did the binding. Oh my lord, that's just
yeah. It's the forcing part, I think, that is the worst of it. But as we've seen, some of them at least probably would not have their bonds released if they could. I mean, Tovain probably would be released from Loghain if she could be. There are a couple of notes here that I think I want to mention. One thing is that she believes that's the first time that she's actually met with a sitter, but she has unknowingly had lessons with at least two heads of Ajas, Adalorna and Sarancha. Adalorna is head of the green, I believe Sarancha is head of the brown. Suan, of course, is also the first weaver of the yellow Aja as well as a sitter. And I think it's also ironic that, again, as pointed out in the notes, which I did not catch, it's ironic that Suana and the other Aja heads are meeting in secret. But then we know they've been doing that for a while. That's Pavara's little group was doing the same sort of thing, you know, with sitters involved in a conspiracy, and now we have Aja heads involved in secret meetings. Not really a conspiracy, but there are definitely currents going on in the White Tower that I hope Egwene will be able to uncover to her benefit.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, and by the way, Sarancha is the head clerk of the Grey Aja, but it is interesting that even though the Aja heads are meeting together and they are trying to coordinate things, still there's this disparity among the Ajas where it's not even safe to go out by yourself. Sisters don't feel safe going out by themselves where they might run into sisters of another Aja. I mean...
I know. That, well, obviously that's Alviarin's doing, and Simper, probably one of the Forsaken, to further split the White Tower and divide it against itself.
Either that or Fane. I really think that there's a strong Fane influence here.
Yeah, he definitely influenced Elida. I mean, he reflected himself that he had brushed her with his taint to the point where she probably might trust her own mother, but nobody else. So they've got that going for them, too. But obviously, that's interesting. I wonder how this is totally a tangent. I wonder how being brushed with the taint of Padan Fane and Eridol will affect her as a Damani. How do you think that's going to affect the person holding the leash? Is that going to speak to the leash, to the leash holder?
Ooh. I never even thought of that. That's a huge problem.
I just thought of it this way.
Because our first thoughts was, yay, Elida's been turned into a Damani. Good riddance.
Woo.
And then my second thought was, crap, now they have the traveling weave. Huh.
Yeah, if they think to ask her about it.
Well, yeah.
We don't know that she would tell them on purpose, but she might to gain favor.
Yeah, if they, yeah. But, you know, that is worrisome. She still has the taint. And I think, this is just my own personal opinion, but I think because of the nature of Mashadar's taint, that what we saw happen in the White Tower was a lot of that taint kind of replicating itself and feeding off of it. And even without Fane there constantly providing the source or what have you, it still grew out from Elida and trickled down through the tower. So I'm worried that even with Elida out of the tower and now in amongst the Shanshan, that we're going to see the taint spread through the ranks of the Shanshan, which is not a good thing. They're scary enough as it is, but can you imagine? But can you imagine Mashadar's taint, the taint of Adderall, in amongst that
Eridol.
Kind of society? Yeah, Eridol. In amongst that kind of society, with that kind of structure, paranoia does not fit anywhere into that command line. It can't, because the way they are raised is the people above me know better than I do, and they are always right. So. If you're paranoid about the people above and around and below you, the Shanshan Empire is going to collapse.
I'm not sure how much it is paranoia as it is the overwhelming desire to defeat the Shadow to the point where they would do anything to do it, and the overwhelming desire to rise to power. If you remember, Mordeth was... He acquired his power by becoming counselor to the king, and crossover alert, in case anybody in the world has not read Lord of the Rings, which I doubt, that goes back to Lord of the Rings, where the Lord of Rohan, I don't know, all the names are escaping me, was basically influenced and almost infected by Wormtongue, whose true name also escapes me. He basically weaseled his way into power as the king's counselor, and then eventually became so manipulative that he basically wielded power through the king. That's what Mordeth did. And that's how he basically ended up destroying the nation of Eridol. And it became, or Aridol, and it became eventually Shadar Logoth after the collapse. But and then Mashadar, I'm not sure, apparently grew out of the taint. Apparently the taint was so bad that even after everybody killed each other off, it took on a life of its own and became the glowing mass of evil flowing through the streets and underground in Aridol. But makes me wonder if the taint might not seep through the leash and then cause the leash holder to try to behave in the same fashion. In other words, getting close to those in power, close to someone of the high blood, or close to the Empress, perhaps even Fortuana, may she live forever. Scary, scary stuff. Well, that was sort of a wild divergence.
yeah, that's kind of far afield of where we needed to go.
No, but it's true, but we were talking about, Elida and her being unlawfully raised and everything, so it sort of fits in, and that might be a topic for another discussion. You know, what is Elida's fate going to be in the land of the Shanshan? Maybe she still has a part to play, even though she's now become a Damani. I can't believe we're really rid of her.
So
bad, it's probably not going to happen.
Well, it's like, before Gathering Storm came out, the review that Jason Denzel did, he said, and I'm paraphrasing a bit, that there were a lot of scenes in this movie that had the same sense of finality that we got with Gabrina. Is that Gabrina? That we got in Knife of Dreams with the Black Aja sister going with...
Oh, Tovaina?
Yeah.
Not sure how you pronounce her name.
What is her name?
I always think of Tovaine, but I don't know that that's right.
Galena, that's her name.
Oh, Galena, yeah.
Yeah, but Jason said that
there were a lot of scenes that, in the book that had the same sense of finality that we had with Galena getting hauled off to
the Travis plaything. Yeah.
And this kind of did have that sense to me. It had that sense of finality. But I can't imagine that it is, because there's so much that Elida's character still has. I mean, this whole issue with the taint, the fact that she knows a lot of kind of hidden and rediscovered, not hidden, but lost ways that have been rediscovered, like gateways traveling, but also inverting weaves. She knows how to do that, and hiding your ability to channel and all these things that the Wonder Girls discovered and or pulled out of Mokiden.
You know, that also means that if Elida could somehow manage to escape the collar, that she could manage to hide herself in Chantan society with the hiding her ability to channel. They wouldn't be able to find her again unless they physically recognized her, because they wouldn't be able to just say, uh-oh, woman who can channel, you know, collar her.
Well, she would still have the ageless face, and they'd be able to recognize that.
Like I said, they'd have to physically recognize her, but if she just, you know, was one of a mass of a crowd, they wouldn't be able to pick her out and grab her. They would have to actually recognize her. Yeah, I don't know. You're right. That scene did have a sense of finality, but it makes me wonder if possibly if she's not going to return, if at least her effects will still be seen, that the things that she might put into play might actually be seen. That's kind of scary.
Well, and you know, the entire idea that this sense of finality, it could just be because Elida is now dead. Sufa is a new character that's taking the place of Elida.
Well, but that's possible too. But as we know, not all scenes of finality are final. Moraine, Lanfear.
Sense of finality with that.
Yeah. Well, I did the first time I read it. I mean, I haven't since, but the first time I read it when there was another book to be coming out and I didn't know. I mean, I hope, but at that time when the book was new and there were no other books to know about, oh my God. Moraine and Lanfear just disappeared through a Turangriel that melted, and Lon feels the bond severed and has had his bond passed to Morella. Well, we knew his bond had been passed. I don't think we knew to whom at that point, but seemed pretty darn final at the time.
Yeah, I never had that luxury when I started reading Knife of Dreams. It was just about to come out, so. We're going to go on now with chapter 13, which is entitled An Offer and a Departure. There are going to be a lot of names in here that don't really know exactly who they are. A lot of them are Aes Sedai. There's a couple of warders and such. So if you want to know who all of the names are in more detail, besides what we'll talk about here, then definitely go to Encyclopedia Watt and look at the chapter summary for chapter 13, because they have links for every name, and you can go see who each of these people are. An Offer and a Departure is from Gawain's point of view, and it starts in Dorlan, where Gawain is practicing swords with two warders who are Sleet and Marlish, while one of the younglings watches. Sleet was seriously wounded at Dumai's Wells and only recently reunited with his Aes Sedai, Hattori. Marlish and his Aes Sedai, Vasha, arrived with the other 11 Aes Sedai. They are the only two warders in Dorlan. Gawain defeats the two of them, despite the fact that Sleet is a blade master who even won bouts with Lon. Marlish says that Gawain should be a blade master, as he killed Hamar. Vasha and Marlish go to see why Narwin's meeting is taking so long. Gawain has not sent out a raid in weeks, as Brine's search parties are getting closer. After the youngling leaves, Sleet tells Gawain that Hattori has been looking for another warder for 10 years and that he would be perfect. Gawain says his loyalty is to Andor and Elaine, and his heart is to Egwene's. They discuss how bad the situation between the Tower and the Rebels is. Sleet says that Hattori went with the embassy to get Rand, only to get out of the Tower herself, not realizing that the real goal was to kidnap Rand and torture him all the way home. Gawain thinks of what a monster Rand is, even though he has been told otherwise many times. As he heads up to the youngling camp, he passes the mayor's house and sees that Vasha was denied entrance. Rajar would have said it is Aes Sedai business, but Gawain is curious. At the back door, Hal Moore lets Gawain enter. Upstairs, Gawain relieves Burden, the guard there. He knocks on Narwin's door, but Kovarla opens it just a crack and tells him to go away. While Gawain waits, he wonders about his loyalty. He does not like Elida, but he chose her side because of what Suan did to Elaine and Egwene. Kervala, Narwin, and Catherine Alruden come down the stairs. Gawain is shocked as Catherine left weeks ago and no one saw her return. He's even more shocked to hear that Egwene is the Armorlin for the rebels and is now a prisoner. He quickly does the sums and figures she was set up as a pawn. Outside the house, Gawain asks another guard, Tando, if anyone saw Catherine enter. No one did. Catherine orders him to step up his raids on the rebel army, saying the new Weaves will make it easy. Gawain goes to his tent and packs a saddlebag to leave. Passing Rajar, he says he's going to inspect an outpost. As Gawain saddles Challenge, his horse, Sleet appears. He knows that Gawain is leaving, but he's not going to stop him. Gawain leaves Thorlan, riding to help rescue Egwene.
Yeah, that's an interesting chapter. I think I would want to start out here with one of the notes that is appended to this chapter summary. Thank you again, encyclopedia-watt.org. It says, it is curious that Rand is so dead set against Elida. Is he just obsessed or has he had undue influence? And I think that's a really interesting concept. He is indeed obsessed against Rand to the point of being beyond reason, especially when his dearly beloved Egwene has told him more than once that Rand is a good person and that Elaine loves him and that he did not kill his mother, Margaes. Right, why is he still so dead certain that Rand must die? Just doesn't make sense. He's really not, by nature, a sort of hard and unforgiving character like that. He's generally a pretty nice guy from everything else that's written about him. You know, why would he just refuse to budge from this position, even though people whose opinions he respects has told him it's just wrong?
It's interesting, especially when we look at the change that has occurred between the Gawain that we see here, this kind of bitter, very pessimistic character, compared to the kind of carefree nature that he had when we first met him in Eye of the World, and even beyond there. Really, it is until the split in the tower. It says here that he chose the side of Elida because didn't like what Suan had, quote unquote, done to Elaine and Egwene, which was she sent them as accepted off on a task that she honestly should have given to sisters. The only reason she didn't is because she didn't know which sisters she could trust, which were Black Aj and which weren't. But still, the idea is that because of the peril, the danger that Suan put these girls in, that's the reason why he took Elida's side over hers. And that's the reason why he killed the two warder masters. It's really interesting just to see how bitter he's become. I mean, even when they first came, the two Trakans and Galad came to the tower, even then he was kind of a very lighthearted spirit, and now he's just this really kind of dark character.
In a way, what's happened with him almost parallels to a much lesser extent Rand's descent into bitterness and almost madness. Obviously, to a much lesser extent, but still astonishing when you think about it. It's so out of character for him. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, what you just said there, it's got me kind of worried. How you say that he's he's almost a reflection, a lesser reflection of the madness that Rand has been sinking into. So I wonder if he's not going to be our counterexample. You know, we've seen Rand descend deep into madness, but now he's starting to come out of it. And I wonder if Gawain won't be our counterexample of what happens when they stay and they embrace the madness and the darkness and the deceit, which would really upset me because I want to see bright, happy ending for Egwene with wedding bells and warder bonds. But that won't
wedding
happen.
Bells and water bombs.
But that like won't it. Happen if Gawain goes crazy, nutso, insane like.
Yeah. It makes me wonder if, you know, his exposure to some of these Black sisters have possibly done, you know, some weaves on him, you know, of compulsion or whatever. And I'm thinking particularly of Catherine because she's a Black sister. And then he was also exposed to Galena. and so forth and so on. I mean, obviously, if they were trying to do compulsion on him, they didn't do a really great job, because even when he was traveling with them to kidnap Rand, he didn't always do exactly what they wanted. They tried to set him up several times to kill him on Elida's orders, and it's amazing that they didn't. I don't know. That's kind of an interesting thing. If he is sort of a lesser parallel of Rand, is he going to have one of those little epiphanies as well and become the Gollum that we know and love?
Okay. See, and that's what I'm afraid of, because if he does have the epiphany, it will seem too much like, oh, look, they're doing that again. And, you know, it's a solution that we've already seen. But if he doesn't, then his character will go into a deep, dark place, and the only possible the most likely scenario in that is Gawain gets himself killed trying to kill Rand.
That'll certainly unravel a lot of plot threads if he gets himself killed. I mean, although it will also resolve one conflict, because I really have a tough time seeing how he's going to be warder and husband to Egwene and first prince of the sword to Elaine. Obviously, the Ammerlin seat can't take off and become an advisor to Elaine of Andor. And we presume that Egwene will stay the Ammerlin seat. I mean, there was a little foreshadowing when one of the sisters said that you realize that Egwene Alvear will be one of the longest reigning Ammerlins of all time because she started so young. And that presumes, of course, that she doesn't die by accident or step down. I could see her stepping down eventually, but whether or not she actually will in any sort of time frame that these books will deal with, I don't know. And Gawain would probably wait for her, but I mean, they might have to have a long distance marriage. They might end up with a long distance marriage like Matt and Tuan.
Well, I wouldn't be surprised if Elaine ended up with someone else to be her, well, basically her Gareth Bryn. Her mother didn't have a first prince of the sword. She had Gareth Bryn, who was the captain of her armies. And I would not be surprised if Elaine gets someone like maybe Perrin or someone else who can come and be the general, be the military advisor that Gawain was supposed to be when Gawain cracks, if Gawain cracks, or if he is warder to the Ammerlin seat.
That's an interesting thought, you know, because obviously Manethrin was a big part of Andor. Perrin could function, although I can't see Perrin and Faile relocating to Camelin in order for Perrin to be Elaine's general.
But they have traveling, he can live wherever he wants.
Well, that's true. They have traveling. They could do it whenever he wants. He'll have to just have an Aes Sedai near him to shuttle him back and forth, but that shouldn't be a problem in the future. Yeah, I suppose it could be.
Or an Ashaman. He has the two or three that have stayed with him and are part of his entourage now.
That's true. That's a really good point. I hadn't actually thought of that. I really haven't given that much thought to what's going to happen to Gawain afterwards. And I'm not sure that, you know, judging from the events later in the book, not all that is peachy keen and rosy with Egwene and Gawain. They've not exactly been embracing cuddly kissy. Like they were, you know, when they first met up again, she barely has time for him.
Well, that's,
you know, and she set him down, you know, she set him down for his behavior really hard once. Anyway, but that's for a future chapter.
Yeah, well, yeah, and I think she was ridiculous in her upset it. Anyway, but
yeah,
no, it is interesting that since the moon-eyed kissy face stage that they had in Carrion, you know, she's grown up and he's kind of grown down. We're free to descend into madness. But, you know, I never really have thought about this, though, is why Gawain is so anti-Rand. But it's always been interesting to me. I've never really, well, it's not always been interesting to me. It would completely something different. Anyway, but it's interesting to me because I've really thought about it until, but now that I'm actually thinking about it logically and applying critical thinking, it seems most likely to me that he is some form of compulsion, either that or the other only thing I see that caused this sort of insanity is the Mashadar's taint.
which I don't know how Gawain would ever come in contact with. I guess it is possible.
No, I mean, it's sort of a stretch to think that he got it from Elida, who he was around a little bit. I'm not sure how fast or how hard that spreads. I remember, I think it was Varen speculating on if the dagger were not removed from Matt, how many people that he came close to it would infect and what the progress would be as it spread through the population. She started going off into some brown nausea, calculating that absolutely horrified everybody around her, like, oh my God, you're thinking about that, you know, but it is apparently a taint that is spreadable like a virus at some point in time and can affect at second and third generations even. But how deeply Elida was touched by it in order to pass it on is probably a question for the Brown, because we don't really have that much to go on other than the fact that we know that it can spread, you know, generationally through a population. So it's,
yeah, well,
it's possible
also,
that he picked up enough of it, but I don't know. And how many
and
of the
also,
other...
We don't know if he's ever had contact with Fane himself. We don't know if he's ever been anywhere near where Fane is. We haven't ever seen it happen, but that doesn't mean it hasn't.
That's a good point.
Because we know that Fane has been in and around Tarvalon, where the younglings are based out of, basically.
Mm-hmm. And Padden Fane hasn't been seen for a while. He could have been anywhere doing anything. You know, he's dropped out of sight.
Yeah, we haven't seen him for a while. But also, yeah, but also we had him in Carheen at one point, near Carheen at one point in time. I don't remember if that was before or after Dumai's Wells. I think it was after.
I think it was before. But no, I think it was after. I didn't mention it. Yeah, I don't know. It's just hard to know. Once you get second and third generation of the taint passing, it also makes me wonder how many of the Aes Sedai in the party that Elida sent might have been brushed with that taint secondhand through Elida or other sisters that are close to Elida. How much of that did Alviarin get, who was already Black Aja and was obviously near Elida a lot and near Padden Fane quite a bit? Remember, they had a personal confrontation in the storeroom in the White Tower.
Yeah.
And it has been pointed out that he doesn't actually have to have physical contact to spread the taint.
No.
He's got, especially with the dagger in his hand, he's powerful enough that he can just, influence those around. I see it kind of like, but I see it strangely enough as, ripples of fog kind of spreading out from wherever he is how I visualize it in my mind.
Yeah, it's like Padden Fane is, what do they call it, the zero vector or whatever. He's the focal point of plague, you know, which it's almost like an airborne, you know, plague. It doesn't actually need physical contact with the person. He just has to be in their vicinity for a certain length of time or presumably certain repeated set lengths of time or something in order to pick up the taint, and then it can be spread from one to the next, and it jumps out incrementally, just like, you know, say the Ebola virus, or might, you know, which has been done in a lot of movies and everything, where, you know, you start out with one person who gets it someplace, and they infect a couple, and then those people infect a whole bunch, and then those people infect, you know, thousands, and then all of a sudden you're up to, you know, tens of thousands of people who have been infected with this thing that started with one person. It just takes, especially if it's airborne. I mean, if it takes physical contact, it's not as easy to spread it. But if it's airborne, boy, it can go through a population really fast.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know.
But I don't know how long, you know, we don't have any information on how long a person needs to be exposed to the taint in order to get it. Is it an all or nothing thing, or if they're just like casually near a person now and again, do they just pick up a little of it, or do they get, you know, the whole dose, and it just takes time to, you know, sort of brew in them before they spread it to somebody else? We know nothing about the virulence or the time factors involved in this. Obviously, it's not immediate and complete, or it would have already spread through the population of the White Tower and out into the world and anybody else, all of the White Cloaks that, you know, he was with Pedro Niall, so all of the White Cloaks have had a chance to pick up some of this taint to one extent or another. I mean, when you think of all the populations that Padden Fane has had a part of for some point in time, the Seanchan in Falna, that's a lot of people. We just don't know the extent and the virulence.
No.
I mean, it could almost have spread through an entire population at this point in time. It has, but it has to be limited because not everyone's become as evil as Aradol. So maybe if they just have, you know, a passing second generation taint like Gawain with Elida, maybe that's not enough to do more than make them bitter and obsessed rather than just evil.
Yeah. Yeah. And we don't know what Haddon Fain has been doing, but I doubt that he currently has the full power of Mordeth and Mashadar with him. He's probably growing and going to have that power shortly, soon, if he doesn't right now, and we're probably going to see him in the next book exercising the power and coming back into play, because he can't just disappear, drop off the face of the earth after Rand slices at him in Carheon. So it's going to be interesting.
Well, he was in Far Madding, but he still has the dagger.
Yeah, he still does.
And the dagger itself, apart from
Haddon
Fain.
Oh, he wasn't Far Madding.
No, it wasn't Far Madding. He has the dagger, and the dagger itself is enough to spread the taint, whether it's with Haddon Fain or not. That's why they were so dead set about not touching it and keeping it in a, you know, lead-lined box and all this sort of stuff. It's almost like radiation poisoning. You know, it's just a matter of time before you get a lethal dose if you're around it or, God forbid, touch it. So that's really kind of, boy, he's been around so many people since he had his run-in and merged with Mordeth. But anyway, we spent a lot of time talking about Gawain, which is great because the chapter was from his point of view, but we haven't yet mentioned one of the other pivotal characters in this episode, and that is the Warder Sleet. I have to think he's going to have a role to play because here we have a brand new character introduced at this late date, and he's, he's another wunderkind. I mean, the guy's, you know, actually defeated Lan in Practice Bouts. You know, he's like an uber blade master. He's a very powerful character. You know, where are we going with this guy?
It was interesting to me to see the off to become a warder for her. You know, obviously he's been planning on being someone's warder, and we know that he'd be very good at it, and I think it's just interesting to have another warder say, you know, we could use you.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder what will become of that, because it's not just randomly there.
Yeah, I think the only other thing that really bothers me about Sleet is he's another super character in a way. I mean, to actually be another blade master on a level with Lan, on a level with Gawain. Gawain's a super blade master. I mean, he wasn't even fully trained when he killed Kamar and Kulin. And, you know, it just, there are, and forgive me, I'm not a writer. I want to be, but not a writer. And not even a really good critic. But if there's one thing that bothers me about this series, it's the fact that there are so many uber characters, so many people that are, I mean, the three girls, wow, the most powerful three ever to enter the tower since who knows when. And Rand, you know, the most powerful male channeler ever since. And Matt, you know, the most wonderful general since Arthur Hawkwing. And Perrin, you know, da-da-da-da-da. The Wolf King, beyond all Wolf Kings. And well, I mean, they're all just so good. I mean, obviously, we can explain it by the pattern needing these people to put things back into balance. It's almost too much, and I don't think that we need another super character. And don't get me started on bringing balance to the pattern, because we know where that happened with the Force and the Jedi. I mean, that's one thing I could never figure out. They're waiting for the chosen one to come along and restore balance to the Force. Well, they were like all good Jedi and a couple of Sith. What did they think was going to happen when they restored balance? Duh. Not so many good guys anymore. Lots of bad guys running around. That wasn't a good thing. If you were a Jedi, anyway. If you were a Sith Lord, it was great. So, I mean, it's kind of like, okay, well, now we have, you know, now it's probably okay for the side of the light because we have, you know, the resurgence and the rise of the shadow taking over, and so bringing balance back to the pattern will probably be good from Rand and basically our perspectives, but kind of got to be careful with restoring balance. It's not always a great, it's not going to be lollipops and roses here necessarily.
Yeah, restoring balance is not creating a utopia. Balance is creating regular. It's good parts bad, good parts evil.
Yeah, not everybody's going to be running around pooping rainbows, you know?
Yep.
So, but I just wonder what part sleep's going to play in this. It sort of jarred me that we had this is a point in time when we need to be wrapping up plot lines, not bringing in new, presumably important, if not major, characters. So he's got to have some big role to play. And of course, he's already the warder to Hattori, so he can't become, well, I guess he could. I mean, he couldn't become Egwene or Elaine's warder or whatever, unless Hattori was killed. But then that's actually not true, because we have Rand being warder to four women, you know.
Well, bonded anyway. He doesn't really act very well in the whole warder capacity idea.
Yeah.
Another tangent here, it's interesting to me to see what Elida has been doing with. I mean, honestly, a lot of these things that she's been telling him to do seem like they're an attempt to get rid of him, which I think is really an interesting thing for Elida to do. I mean, she's known him. She's been the advisor in Andor since probably, if not before, then shortly after he was born. So why in the world is she trying to get rid of him?
I missed part of that because it broke up. Was that who's trying to get rid of who? Egwene's trying to get rid of Gawain?
Elida's trying to get rid of Gawain.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. Again, I some of Elida's actions are just inexplicable unless you assume that she's been infected by Padden Fane's taint or under compulsion by some of the Black Sisters. I mean, obviously, she's had a Black Sister for her keeper all this time, Aldiaran. She's good buddy buddies with Katarina Alruddin, one of the few she trusts, another Black, you know, Galena, another Black. You know, she trusted Galena to go do the abduction of Rand. I mean, she's been, you know, cheek to jowl with Black Sisters right, left, and center. The fact that she's not one is astonishing to me, but she certainly surrounded herself with them. That's the only explanation that I can think of why she'd want to get rid of Gawain after having a lifelong association and knowing that he's not he's not an evil person or anything. He's just a pretty nice guy. And, I mean, presumably she still wants, you know, good for Andor. And, you know, she's going to think that Elaine is going to need Gawain as her first Prince of the Sword. Why is she so dead set on killing him? There's got to be something else going on with that. Elida was just completely around the bend, too, but.
Well, we do know that Mesaana has been in the White Tower, and it's not a far stretch to imagine that she would have compulsed Elida to make her act even more crazy. I mean, honestly, the whole let the Lord of Chaos rule, a good way to induce chaos is to kill the Queen of Andor's prime general that he's supposed to have, incarcerate him such that he's, or not incarcerate, but, you know, keep him busy. Yeah, keep him so busy that he can't go back to Andor and help fix whatever's wrong there. I mean, does he even know that Andor was Camelin and Elaine were besieged for several months?
Probably not. How would he? You know, how would he know?
Because if he had known, I guarantee you he would have taken the younglings down there. He would not have, well, he might have just gone himself. He might have been stupid enough to try that. But I don't think he would have. I think he would have taken the younglings down there and taken care of it.
Maybe so.
I gotta wonder what the younglings are thinking now that the tower's been reunited and suddenly Gawain's with, what? Who, huh?
Wait, what?
What? Who, huh?
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of, wow. You know, when you think about it, there's just so much in that.
Yeah, there's just so much in this whole relation, the whole thing with the younglings and Gawain and Elida and Egwene and Elaine and all of this weird, not really triangle, more of a, it's just weird. And there's so much there. It's amazing when you look at how much is just in these little things. But you think about what Robert Jordan put into these things. And these are not main characters. Egwene, yes, you could argue that she's a main character. But really, these are not the main characters, and yet they have as much character as Rand and Matt and Perrin and their respective honeys.
Yeah, I know. It's really quite astonishing when you think about it. And again, I have to give, obvious, but I mean, you have to give major kudos to Robert Jordan because he has plot lines going on with some of these minor characters that are almost worthy of a book in and of themselves. And yet they're all interwoven into this enormous tapestry of, you know, the pattern that basically he's evolved with this book. It's really quite astonishing when you think about it. If you actually dissect all this stuff, you could probably make any number of really good short stories, if not full-scale novels, just on, you know, just leaving aside all the other stuff going on and just taking out the relevant parts and the little background for, say, Gawain and Egwene, or, you know, any number of other characters you choose.
Oh yeah,
really?
Well,
amazing.
Think about how many pieces of fan fiction have been able to be written off of this, because, and not just random fan fiction. I mean, you can find fan fiction for everything, but actual good solid works of fan fiction, because the world is so detailed and we know so much about it as readers. Obviously, the author knows more about it than we do, but he has given us so much knowledge of it that we're able to create our own fantasies inside the world.
Yeah.
And it's really amazing. And not even that, but then beyond that, his ability not only to know about his world, but to be able to describe it in notes and writings and talks with other people enough that someone else can come and finish it.
I know, really, you can't think of too many other things on that sort of scale, except maybe the Star Trek world and the Star Wars world, really are, I think, the big ones. I mean, Lord of the Rings is a lesson point, but I don't think Lord of the Rings ever spawned the fan fiction that Star Trek and Star Wars have, and The Wheel of Time. I mean, I'm sure there are others that I'm overlooking, and feel free to, you know, tweet me about that, listeners, if you can. But
well, it seems to me that the Lord of the Rings really wasn't as an open world. It centered on a few characters, and you knew a lot about those characters and where they were, but you didn't know much about the world at large. And it wasn't a big, the Wheel of Time has a huge ensemble of characters. And we know that these people exist all over the place in so many different ways. And it's amazing. And that is what spawned the fan fiction. The fact that we know that these people exist and could be out there. I mean, Lord of the Rings, what kind of fan fiction? Maybe a soldier at Gondor would be probably the most interesting one you could come up. Either that or Rohan.
Someone named Rohan, yeah.
And those are pretty much it.
Well, or I suppose, you know.
I mean, you could write one as a hobbit, but it would be kind of boring.
Yeah, or you could go back, I mean, I suppose, in the history, you know, and, you know, someplace in the Elven Kingdom before the fall. And, I mean, you could do stuff from the past, but basically the whole world was wrapped up with a little bow and set aside. You know, there wasn't much to go on with from that, like you say, except to go retire in peace in Hobbiton, you know. But,
But with
getting back
like
to
this,
the...
I mean, honestly, let's randomly think of, okay, an innkeeper in Saldea. What can we do with the story? Well, we can do Trollocs and Mydrol attacking, and he has to help defend the town, and it's just a random innkeeper in Saldea, and you can do a very good and powerful short story on that because of the world that Robert Jordan has created.
Yeah, it's really, really, really astonishing when you think about it. And there's, you know, much more possible. I mean, Brandon has said that he and Harriet may consider doing the Outrigger novels, but probably not much more than that, if they even do those. But, I mean, we know that one will be on Matt and Tuan, because Jordan said so. But we don't really know what the others would be. But there's so much to choose from. And if they wanted to, they could keep this series going for another 20 years just based on the stories that are already in play and not much else. But I don't think they're going to. And that kind of makes me sad. I mean, it's probably what RJ would have wanted. But I would really miss it if there wasn't. I mean, we do know that there's going to be another encyclopedia coming out, hopefully much, much better than the Big White Book, which was good in its way, but stopped, you know, relatively early on in the series. So there are going to be more things coming along with the Wheel of Time, but at least we hope so. But really and truly, I mean, they could carry it on for a long time if they so desired, and I wish they would. I really do. I think, you know, maybe Brandon doesn't really want to because he has his own writing career. He doesn't really want to be, you know, RJ2 for the rest of his career. But then writing these books. I mean, when you think about that, I'm going to digress again. This is another tangent, but kudos to Brandon, because not only, I mean, think of this compared to the writing speed of Robert Jordan, say, not that I'm criticizing RJ, but he wasn't fast. When you think about, even despite the fact that he had the fully fleshed plot line ready to roll and Robert Jordan's notes and tapes and everything else and staff to help him, not only did he finish his assigned book within an amazingly short period of time after Robert Jordan's death and his selection, but he's got another one finished 1 year after The Gathering Storm. I mean, Tellers of Midnight is at the presses right now. It's going to be released in November.
Yep. And he wrote his own epic fantasy.
I was just going to say, he finished up Warbreaker. He finished up Way of Kings. He did one of his Alcatraz young readers novels. He's published and finished up a Mistborn. He finished the last Mistborn book all during this period of time of his own. I mean, talk about prolific. Well, the guy is a workaholic. We're going to have to sit on him to probably keep him from killing himself. But he thinks of himself a little bit as Perrin, but I see him more as Randolph Orr. He needs a group of maidens around him to keep him from using himself up until he drops dead.
Yeah, I got to say, I think it's great timing for the Way of Kings to start, right, as we're wrapping up the Wheel of Time, because we'll just be able to go right into our next epic drama, and it'll be great.
So we're going to leave Gawain in Chapter 13, riding to help rescue Egwene. Da-da-da! Her White Knight is on the way. How cool is that? So I guess one other final comment. Maybe you can kind of cut this ahead. Again, I find it highly suspect that Katarina Rudin is one of the sisters entrusted with traveling by Elida. Again, black sister. I see compulsion, possibly. Surely Masana has had some influence on Elida. We haven't seen it directly. I mean, we know she's got Alviarin under her thumb completely, and now Alviarin is basically transferred to being a direct one-on-one minion of the Dark One because she was physically touched by Shardar Haran, who is the hand of the dark. Yeah, creepy ain't the word for it, my dear. Creepy to the max. So, yeah. Now, of course, Elida's out of the picture. So going on to Chapter 14, which is entitled A Box Opens. This is from Catswain's point of view. Catswain, one of Brandon Sanderson's least favorite characters and one of my almost favorite characters. Second tier, definitely. Anyway. From Catswain's point of view, Catswain, Bear, and Sorlia, the Wise Ones, are newly arrived from Bandar Iban. They regard Semirag. Daigian and Sarine are outside the door holding Semirag's shield. Catswain is using flashing lights and ringing for sleep deprivation. That's pretty advanced stuff, really. Sorry, no comment. Sorlia asks to speak to Semirag, and the leaves stop. Semirag makes a normal, cruel statement. And Sorlia responds that Semirag seems more human than she expected, and this seems to annoy Semirag. She responds that she would like to see how hard she has to push to make an Aiel kill a blacksmith. After the weaves are reset, Sorlia says they should kill her. She is too dangerous. Catswain agrees she is dangerous, but she has valuable knowledge of weaves and the other Forsaken that they need, and that the Forsaken are not as twisted as Murdral or Drakkar or other Shadowspawn. They're just still humans. Oddly, according to Rand, the Forsaken are very human, being petty, destructive, and argumentative, which we know from first-hand experience of reading about them. As they leave, Catswain instructs Daigian and Sarine to make sure she is kept awake. They then go to Catswain's room. On the way, she thinks how far she still has to go to get Rand ready for the last battle. In her room, a battered document box contains certain special items that she has warded with inverted weaves. Catswain then disarms the box and opens it. It reveals the access key, one of the Chodan Kal, and the original sad bracelets. Catswain left the item, the sad bracelet copies, and Kalendor with some retired Aes Sedai. Catswain tested the item on herself and could not escape. Sorlia says that Rand has now grown worse, and Catswain agrees, and they set to making a plan to deal with this. So here we
I just want to say right out of the start that whoever Catswain had with her when she was testing the item should have just left it on her.
Oh, that's cold. That's really cool, Spencer. You apparently are not a fan of Catswain.
I never said that, but I'm not.
Well, one might infer from that comment you wish her to become Damani, basically, or at least subservient to another Aes Sedai. I don't think they could do that. How do you fit that in the trio? I mean, yeah, there isn't really anything to stop them, I guess. Well, a cat swaying being held by a leash, that's kind of scary. How are you getting over her?
I think it would be helpful. I think that Rand could get a lot more out of her if she had an Eidolon around her neck.
You may be right, but that probably doesn't fit with the part that she has to play.
I might be crazy. Sorry.
I'm not crazy, I'm just a little... Okay, we got that Spencer's not a Cad Swain fan, that's fine. I think it's interesting that Cad Swain is still real chummy with the wise ones.
Hey, I'm a huge fan of Cad Swain, as long as she's...
Leashed. Properly leashed. Yeah, well, but how does that fit in with the speculation that we and many others have had that Cad Swain, I'm not going to go there. I'm just imagining Cad Swain and another Aes Sedai slapping those sad bracelets on Rand. That to me would be beyond scary. You know,
I don't think she could ever do it because the moment that she did, she would get stabbed in the head by men.
Oh, but yeah, but
she doesn't have
a
warder.
She couldn't because whatever she did to whoever was holding the bracelets would affect Rand so negatively. You know, it's just like Fael joking about how she would do for Alana if Alana ever, you know, bonded Perrin. And, you know, the other Aes Sedai are going, well, she obviously just knows nothing about the water bond, or she wouldn't even consider what that would do to him. You know, she wouldn't consider doing that considering what would happen to the water involved. No, I don't know. Now, one thing I'm wondering about the sad bracelets, those particular original sad bracelets had been obviously used and had this feeling of sadness and woe and pain. But is that necessarily an aspect of the bracelets, or was that just from that one set's prayer use? Are the copies that Elaine has apparently made, or someone has made, not Elaine, I guess, that Masana had made, their new fresh ones, would they necessarily have that sadness and woe involved in them if they were brand new and never used? I mean, this might actually
well,
be
I think
kind
so.
Of a,
I think,
yeah, I think
I
it
think
might be
that,
kind of a handy way for, you know, a handy way for channelers to link if they didn't want to do a circle.
They should just do
but,
a circle.
You know, but really, what's the
but
point?
I think that they would simply because when you copy something, you're copying it in its current form. If they're copying the sad bracelets, they'll copy them with the whatever imperfections that have occurred over time to make them the sad bracelets.
Maybe. I'm not that familiar enough with how Tyrandriel are copied. I feel like that the sadness from usage wouldn't necessarily get copied with the physical structure. But then we don't really know that much about Tyrandriel, so I guess it's idle speculation. I do think it's really fascinating that Cad Swain has adopted modern interrogation techniques, you know, sleep deprivation and flashing lights and everything like that. I mean, what was she, CIA? I mean, come on. Next to be waterboarding her, you know. And Rand apparently he doesn't know or doesn't have a problem with keeping her awake.
Apparently not. That's obviously not a form of torture, I guess.
In his mind. Well, I have to tell you, it's a very effective interrogational technique and actually probably just as destructive as physical pain or more in some ways. Sleep deprivation is not a lot of fun, especially when you add the flashing lights and sounds and everything involved in it. That's a really quick way to, you know, basically break somebody, and people in our modern times have known that for years. I mean, just disorienting somebody and keeping them asleep is enough to, almost anybody will break in about a week or less, a lot less. Anyway, that's from what I've read. Anyway, I've never actually done it. Well, let's see what else have we got in this chapter. I wonder who Cad Swain trusted to hold the Eidolon to test it on her. If I were an Aes Sedai, I don't know if I would really trust anybody to put an Eidolon on me.
Does it actually say in the text anywhere?
I don't think so. I think it would have been mentioned here.
Let me check my book.
It doesn't say. It says one of the first things Cad Swain had done after capturing those female Eidolon was put one on and practice ways to escape from it. She'd done so under carefully controlled circumstances, of course, with women she trusted to help her escape. They'd eventually had to do that. Cad Swain had been able to discover no way out on her own.
That's because they're not built for getting out of.
That's really interesting. I wonder which one she did trust. I guess one of her little coterie followed her around, Daigien and some of those others, Corel, you know, Serene, a few of them. I guess she trusts them well enough to do it. Or she could have asked Soralia. She can channel it just barely. That's an interesting thought. Imagine Soralia, who can barely channel, collaring somebody like Caswain.
Well, here's the thing, though. If I'm remembering correctly, the Adam has an inverse effect on the woman if someone who can channel is trying to get her out of it. So it has to be a non-channeler. I know that if a man who can channel gets them out of it, then there's problems, because we saw that with Mogden being released by Halima. But
They feel pain. It's painful for them to touch it. But another channeling woman can. No, they can't. Otherwise, the two collared Domani, or the two collared Soldam, would have released each other. And why didn't? Oh no. Of course, I guess I'm thinking of I can't think of the names now. The two Soldam that Egwene, Elaine, and Nin left collared in the room in Falme.
It's Bethamon and...
Bethamon, yeah, Bethamon and...
Is it Bethamon and Seda? Because I know that those are the two that... I know that those are the two that traveled with Matt, but are they both ones that... are they both the ones that were collared then?
I don't think it was Bethamon. That was the one that... I can't think of her name either. Adianan caught. It was Seda and Renna, I think. Seda and Renna were the two. But anyway, they can't touch the power while wearing the collar without excruciating pain or at all. And so they couldn't release it with the power, which I think is how most channeling women would do that. Because didn't Nynaeve use a little whip crack of the power to snap the bracelet off of that one in the street that they snagged so that they could get the bracelet to use for the rescue?
Oh, yeah, she did, didn't she?
Yeah, so somebody who's not wearing the bracelets or the collar can take it off with the power, but I don't think, because the Demani are not allowed to channel without permission, they couldn't do it to each other, so they couldn't physically touch it, or they would have just taken them off each other because of the pain factor. So how else do you put that thing on? I mean, a woman who could channel, a Soldam can snap the thing on somebody without having pain.
Yeah,
I mean,
I don't know.
The Soldam can snap it on, and they're touching it when they put it on the woman. I mean, you can't just like throw it at them and have it attached to their neck. You have to be able to physically, there's going to be a second or two when you are in contact with the woman's collar while she's wearing it before you can release it. That's an interesting question. I have to go back and look at that again. You have to touch it while you collar them, and there's going to be a second or two where it's going to hurt, unless the woman wearing the bracelet can touch the collar of the woman that she's collared with impunity, because it's part of the link. Just someone else who can channel can't touch the collar if they're not wearing the bracelet. Maybe that's it. It has to be it. Anyway, you missed your chance to see Caswain get collared and stay that way. So.
Yeah, I know. Anyway.
You know, so what else does Caswain think she needs to do to Rand to get him ready for the last battle? I mean, you know, is she still trying to manipulate him? Obviously. Is she still think that there's stuff that she can do to change him?
I think that's what she's hoping. I think she's trying to get him to be more human. Well, we see with the tricks and schemes that she tries later in the book that she's trying to get him to be more human before he has to actually go and face the last battle. What is it? Get him to laugh and cry before he.
Yeah, laughter and tears. Yeah.
Yeah, but it wasn't that the promise she made with Soralia that they would get him to laugh and cry before the last battle?
Yeah. Well, here's another interesting little point, which I confess went right past me. Thank you, Encyclopedia Watt, for the footnote here. Caswain left the Idom, the sad bracelet copies, and Kalendor with some retired Aes Sedai. What'd she leave him with? Where are they? And she can travel now, so I guess she can get him at any time. But who in the world do you trust with objects with a power like that? Calendar? Why wasn't Calendar left with Nerishma?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who she would leave him with. That's a good question.
And where's Nerishma? Is he still with her and Rand?
I think so.
So why would she ditch Calendar? I thought he was the one who was supposed to come after.
Right. Was Nerishma the one that went to the Saladar Aes Sedai in Knife of Dreams?
Yeah, along with Maurice. I think he's Maurice's warder, isn't he? Yeah, he is. I have to look it up.
So,
I'm sure he is.
So are they still there, or have they left?
Well, I don't remember. Let me go check with Encyclopedia Watt. Yep, Cad Swain and Narishma watch as Maurice questions Semirog in Chapter 5 in The Gathering Storm. Dan meets with the Aiel chiefs, Flynn, etc., Wise Ones, and Narishma to discuss the plan for Adalmon. Narishma opens gateways for Ran, Bashir, and the soldiers to inspect northern Saldia and inspect the Blight. Cad Swain, Maurice, and Narishma check on Rand after the attack. Rand shows Narishma the weave for Balefire? I forgot that. That's in Chapter 23.
Ooh.
Ooh, doggies. I didn't know he taught anybody that one.
He must trust him.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think even Loghain knows that one.
I missed that. They all went to him with him to Bandar Iban. They were all with him when he met with Tuon. They were all with him when he and the 200 Aiel accompanied Rand to his meeting with the Borderlanders. So Narishma is still with Rand. Why is Calendar not? With A, the Dragon Reborn, or B, Narishma, who is supposedly the one who comes after. That makes no sense to me.
Because after the cleansing, Cad Swain took, because it was apparently her God-given right as an Aes Sedai to randomly steal things from various Ashaman and hide them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that kind of surprises me. That surprises me. Oh, well. Okay,
but is the last time we saw Kalendor was the cleansing.
Yeah. Did Narishma have it after that?
No, Narishma had it at the cleansing, but not since then, I don't think.
Items, let me just check on Kalendor.
Yeah, the last time we actually see it is Winter's Heart. It's mentioned in Knife of Dreams because the Defenders of the Stone are still guarding the Heart of the Stone, even though Kalendor is gone.
Right.
But,
Kesley got it and left it. So, yeah, that was it. Rand had it, and she took it to these retired Aes Sedai, whoever they might be. And who do you trust with that?
I don't know. Another group of retired Aes Sedai? Thought the only ones there were Vandine and Adis, but they've come out of retirement now, and one of them died. No, both of them are dead now.
All right, so I think that's going to be the last of the chapters for this episode. We want to thank you for tuning in and listening. If you want to leave us any feedback, if you want to leave us some feedback, you're always welcome to leave us a voicemail. The number for that is 888-333-7690.
You can also reach us by email at podcast@dragonmount.com, and one or more of us will usually respond to you within the day.
And also with Dragonmount 8.0 out, I don't know if the URL is the same. I hope it is. But you can get us, but our homepage is dragonmount.com/podcast. And if that's no longer true, then Mr. Editor, please, or Mrs. Editor, please cut that out and don't include it at all. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook, The Fourth Age, or The Fourth Age Podcast, or just Fourth Age, any of the three. It switches between them.
And also our host, DragonMount.com, is on Facebook and Twitter at the appropriate username, DragonMount. So I think that will probably wrap us up for this time. We'll be back again in the next episode, continuing through our review of The Gathering Storm. Until then, this is Virginia, and may the light illumine you until we meet again.
And until next time, may you find water and shade.
Podcast. Back to the podcast, which is already in progress.
It is? What? Wait, huh?
Yeah, wait, what?
Wait, to where?
No!
Ah, whatever.
Well, getting back on topic, because we're way off of it now.
No, we're not. We're on the cover art.
We're talking about Moraine, not the cover art.
Well?
Moraine is not on that cover art.
But she's all tied up with it because the cover art depicts the beginning of the rescue of Moraine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. All right.
And it was the cover art that inspired this topic about Moraine.
Mm-hmm.
And because I said so.
You know, if you weren't the producer, that impeccable logic would be invalid.
but you're the producer, so okay, fine.
No! No, I'm just fresh out of suitably I said I answers. I'm sorry.